should be able to also do it. It can be an easy job. You want to come closer? You're always far off. So allow me to speak a little less loudly. So today we're discussing about urinary tract infections. They're very commonly encountered infections in your clinical practice. Although the sufferers will be females most of the time, but you'll often be seeing males as well. So pay a little bit of attention. Mm-hmm. Because in the clinics, in the ER, many areas, you'll come across such patients. This is an old slide, but just to highlight the fact that it's a very commonly encountered infection. Chest infections are urinary tract infections, these are the common ones. And easy to diagnose if they are treated early in the course. Majority of them, they just involve the bladder. We call them cystitis. The rest of them, they involve other part of the urinary tract. There are different ways to classify them. So I'll come to that course a little later. So just highlighting again the facts of how common it is in males and females. This is regarding females. Half of the females during all their entire reproductive life, that's when they are young, they will get at least one episode of UTI. It's such a common disorder. So it's very common in females, especially the young child-bearing females. The risk increases after the menopause when the vaginal mucosa becomes atrophic. And quite a significant portion of those UTIs, that's about 20 to 40%, will have recurrence. They will come again and again. And most of them will be reinfections. I'll tell you what is the difference between reinfection and relapse. Some kind of UTIs, we call them asymptomatic bacteriuria. I'll tell the details of that definition. But just to let you know that as the age advances, the incidence of asymptomatic bacteriuria, it increases, reaches up to 50% in very elderly ladies. This is very common in those who are destitute of staying at old homes. As far as males are concerned, it is rather rare infection in the males, especially the younger ones. And we do encounter in younger males, when especially those patients who are admitted in the hospital, who get insertion of polyscarb duty for any reason, or who undergo any kind of urological procedure like cystoscopy or anything, when done for the lower urinary tract. Again, bacteriuria in elderly males is again a common disorder, and especially those, there are certain high-risk groups, like the ones who are staying in hospitals for a long time, or those who are in rehabilitation centers or nursing homes, is commonly seen in these kind of patients. Again, when a patient gets insertion of polyscarb duty for any reason, you can see that the risk increases almost 10 times. Very common. If you walk in the corridor, you will see at least along the urology ward, people carrying their bags along with their hands. And now, why this is a common disorder in females? It's for simple reason. They have short urinary tract. The urinary infection ascends through the around the periurethral tissues into the bladder. In the males, urinary tract is rather quite long. It has tortuous course. Probably that inhibits development of infection in males. Females, being it is short, that's why they develop this infection very commonly. Especially after when they become reproductive during their sexual contacts, because during intercourse there's a possibility that periurethral tissues may get colonized. And some of the females, when they use spermicidal agents or oral contraceptive devices, again that puts them at danger of developing this infection. Males, as I already told you, is rare disorder in males. However, if they get prostatic infection, then again they are at risk. Or if there are certain anatomical defects in the urinary tract, again that's a risk factor. the risk factor in those patients who don't undergo circumcisions or homosexuals. Yes, sir. UTIs are common in probably, I don't know whether in a certain ethnic group they don't do circumcisions, so it's commonly seen in them. This is probably the same thing which I was telling you, just to tell you that in males it is rather uncommon during the younger period. However, it is commonly during infancy or when they get old. This is the time when the prostate enlarges, and that is the time when your hair become gray. So at the same time, prostate usually enlarges, and that causes retention of urine in the bladder. Again, very high significant risk factor. In females, it is all along, it is commonly seen, especially during the honeymoon period or during pregnancy. Asymptomatic bacterial is also common among females, and the incidence rises as the age advances. Now, how you classify a urinary tract infection? It's very easy to understand. There are different ways to classify them. Either you classify them according to the anatomical area which gets infected. Suppose if there is upper urinary tract, we'll call it upper UTI. If it involves a lower urinary tract, we'll call it lower urinary tract infection. And which area is upper UTI, urinary tract area, and which is lower, that is the bladder. Bladder and below is called lower urinary tract area. No need to write, it's everything written in the books. Just try to understand the things. And any area above the bladder is called upper urinary tract. So any infection involving bladder and below is a lower UTI. Any infection involving bladder, above the bladder, especially the kidney parenchyma, is called an upper UTI, for simple reasons. Some people classify them according to the symptoms. Like if patient comes with symptoms, along with certain other findings, we'll call them symptomatic UTI. Simple reasons, nothing difficult to understand. And sometimes you do certain tests and you find there are evidences of urinary tract infection, but patient does not present with any symptoms. So we'll call those situations asymptomatic urinary tract infection. Some people classify and call them whether they are sporadic, that means they come occasionally. They may call them, or if they come recurrent, we call them recurrent. But when we call them sporadic, if they have at least, I think this is not correct, less than 2 UTI in 6 months period, we call them sporadic infection. If they develop more than 2 episodes of urinary tract infection in a 6 month period, we call them recurrent infections. Some people classify according to complications. Whether it is a complicated UTI or uncomplicated UTI. It's again a very simple one. If patient, I'll tell you the details when we call them complicated or uncomplicated urinary tract infection. Now, this is the same thing I was alluding to earlier. So, infection below the bladder, if it involves urethra, it is called urethritis. If it involves bladder, it's called cystitis. And if it involves prostate, it's called prostatitis. So, simple. And again, above this area is called urinary tract, upper UTI. That involves the kidney parenchyma, involves the pyelonephritis, or if there is extension of the infection around the perinephric tissues, we call it perinephric abscesses, they can develop into that situation. Now, I was talking to you about when we call them complicated and uncomplicated urinary tract infection. Suppose if a patient develops urinary tract infection, normal urinary tract, which is structurally normal or functionally normal. So I'm stressing on the two words, structure and function. If the urinary tract is normal in both the situations, but patient still gets a urinary tract infection, that is called an uncomplicated UTI. And if the person gets infection in the presence of any abnormality in the urinary tract, that is called a complicated urinary tract infection. The prognosis is different. Treatment is different. So this try to understand the situation. Any infection involving a normal urinary tract is considered an uncomplicated UTI. And again, any infection involving an abnormal urinary tract is considered a complicated UTI. Yes, sir. I think we'll leave the question till then. So try to, let's finish this thing. And if you have questions, I'll be more happy to answer them. Some people say that a UTI which generally happens in a young lady who is non-pregnant, who is not pregnant, in her reproductive life, that is considered an uncomplicated urinary tract infection. And rest of all are considered complicated. Some people divide like this. Like suppose Any infection occurring in men is considered a complicated UTI. Any infection in children, pregnant women, or catheters, they are all considered under the same heading of complicated UTI. This is another way to differentiate among them. This is more easily understood in the clinical sense. So if a male comes with UTI, considered as a complicated UTI, treat it as such. If a pregnant lady comes, treat it more seriously. These are more serious infections in children. But if a young lady comes, reproductive age, who is not pregnant, consider uncomplicated UTI. Now, why is urinary tract infection happens in a person? So obviously, for any disease, there is an interplay of between host factors and bacterial factors. So it depends which one is stronger. So human beings have developed certain systems to avoid infections or to prevent infections, but obviously pathogens, or bacteria or viruses, they have also developed certain factors to overcome those defenses. There are many human factors which prevent against developing infection. The most easier one is to understand is this flushing mechanism. Urine passes by like a flush system, and that prevents for the adherence of bacteria to the mucosa. Urine pH is acidic, that again inhibits growth of any pathogen. pH is less than 6. Vaginal secretions, they are also acidic. They also suppress colonization of the bacteria. There are certain proteins secreted in the tubules of the kidney. They are called TAM, horse valve. This is the most common kind of protein which is produced by the cells around the lower urinary tract. They also block growth of certain organisms like E. coli. And some people say there are certain chemotactic factors as well. These are just few host defense mechanisms. In addition to these mechanisms, some people say there's some production of antibodies along the urinary tract, which again prevents or inhibits the adherence or growth of urinary pathogens. Among the people say they can produce, there are certain plasma cells along the lining which produce IgA kind of antibodies, and certain IgA, although the role of these antibodies is not clear, but they do have been mentioned in the reports. Now, I mentioned about complicated and uncomplicated urinary tract infection. There are certain human factors which promotes the growth or development of urinary tract. And so I'll tell the details of them, but just remember, like suppose if there is stasis of urine in the bladder for any reason, that can cause growth of organisms. If the flow in the urethra is turbulent, suppose if there is a stricture in the ureter, or urethra, that will cause stasis, retention of urine, that can cause, and again, if there is certain antibodies present in the bladder or anywhere, like stones, like catheters, that again is a risk factor. After the menopause, patients will get some atrophy of the vaginal mucosa, then they lose their defense mechanism. Vesico urethral reflux, the term is reflux, it's not reflex. Is sometimes seen in young children. Normally, during maturation, urine comes out of the urethra. But in certain children, instead of coming downwards, because there is a lack of control mechanism in the bladder, it regurgitates back into the kidneys. So those patients, yeah, they commonly develop urinary tract infection. And if this is a group of patients, if they develop UTI, they can have more complicated course, especially diabetic patients, or patients who have children, or patients who have malignant hypertension or chronic pyelonephritis. Let's come to bacterial factors as well. So again, bacteria also over time they have developed certain systems. Some bacteria like E. coli, they have possessed certain kind of antigens. And those bacteria can cause high proportion UTI. There are certain flagellar antigens, capsular and different kinds of antigens. They even have developed certain adherent molecules. Fimbria, pila, these are different structures they have developed over time, which cause them to adhere to the urinary epithelium, urothelium, more easily. they even produce certain enzymes or factors which cause their helps in their growth. Like protease, there's an organ which produces an enzyme called urease. It splits urea into ammonia, and which converts into ammonium ion and helps in their growth and resistant antibiotics. Now, how a patient develops a UTI? Normally, it can be a descending route or it can be ascending route. So, descending route is not a common route. That is, descending means blood borne, where infection comes through the blood and reaches the urinary tract, either the kidneys or somewhere else. But that's usually seen in less commonly, about 10% or so. Majority of the infection, it ascends to the lower urinary tract. So it's an ascending infection. And the source of organism are usually the enteric bacteria, which are present around the urethra. And the initial event is the colonization of the periurethral tissues or in the urethra. And again, this is that's the reason why it is more common in females, because they get colonized more easily. And because having a short urethra causes easy penetration, or that's why the bacteria reach the blood more easily. And if the patient is hospitalized, when they get insertion of Paulus catheter, again it causes helps in ascending infection. Instrumentation I already mentioned. If the patient undergoes certain procedures, again there is a chance of colonization of bladder. Bloodborne infections are rare infections, but they do happen in clinical practice. But if there is bloodborne infection, most of the organisms, they are gram-positives or staphylococcus aureus. Kidneys are usually site, especially if there is an entire situation of the tuberculosis. The route is usually bloodborne. Now, this is important to understand. There are certain risk groups or risk factors which puts a patient at danger of developing this kind of infection. There's a list of risk factors. Just some of them I already mentioned. After menopause, there is a decreased resistance of mucous membranes. Sexual intercourse is a risk factor. So that's why people advise that one should micturate after this to avoid any or prevent any UTI. If there is disturbance in functioning of the ureter for any reason, when there is zygourethral reflux, so urine can regurgitate into the kidney again. And this is quite commonly seen in children. This is a birth defect, you can say. Their mechanism is disturbed. If there is uterine prolapse in ladies, this happens in females after multiple pregnancies. Say their anchoring mechanism of the bladder gets disturbed, or so they can develop urine prolapse of the ureter and uterus. So that again causes some retention of the urine in the bladder. Diabetes is a very common disease, and those patients after long, maybe 10-15 years of diabetes, they develop certain complications. And one of the complications is diabetic autonomic neuropathy. So patient can have difficult functioning or disturbed functioning of the urinary bladder, and then again, it's a risk factor. Benign prostatic hypertrophy, BPH, or benign prostatic hyperplasia. So many of the people who are sitting here at once, some of them will develop this disorder. Okay, again, this commonly places them at a risk. So this is very common to see UTIs in patients who have prostatic enlargement. For simple reason, because of retention of urine, so it's a significant reason of UTI in males, especially elderly males. So, and any illness like diabetes or any cause of neurogenic bladder, when the bladder functioning is disturbed, structure is okay. There's no problem with the structure, but the functioning of the bladder is, it does not empty during maturation. again, it's a significant risk factor. This happens after spinal injury. Spine is injured in any case. Then most of the patients, they are bedridden, they will develop bed sore. And one of the complications is they develop frequent urinary tract infections because the bladder is not functioning well because it's all neurogenic virus. Presence of kidney stones or stones anywhere in the urinary tract is an important risk factor. Catheterization of the urinary tract for any reason, as I already mentioned, very commonly seen in those patients. Renal transplantation, when the patient gets artificial new kidneys. So those patients, we give them immunosuppression, certain medications to suppress their immune system. These patients can develop urinary tract infection quite easily. Some of them, again, their ureter is shorter because when it's been transplant kidney is usually placed in the right iliac fossa. It's not its normal location. So ureter is shorter. And if the surgeon has not done, there's different techniques. When they attach the native ureter with the new ureter, so if the technique is not right, again, they can have some reflux of the urine in the transplanted kidney. That's another reason. Let's come to certain terms. I already mentioned some of the terminology. Very easy to understand. There's nothing difficult in this. Cystitis, when there's infection of the bladder. Prostatitis, when infection involves the prostate. Pyelonephritis. Pylon generally is pelvis of the kidneys. So when the infection involves the kidney tissue itself, that is called pyelonephritis. When we call upper urinary tract infection, we generally mean pyelonephritis. So we can use this term interchangeably. Some people use the term urosepsis. It's the same infection, but in addition to that, if patient develops bacteremia, we call that situation urosepsis. So infection has entered the bladder. Perinephric abscess, if patient develops pyelonephritis, and infection extends from the kidney beyond the capsule of the kidney in the perinephric tissues, that situation is called perinephric abscess. Now, how the patient comes to you, how they present, very easy to know. Most obviously, they will present symptoms relating to the urinary tract. If patient is presenting with cough, sputum, you will not think of urinary tract infection. If patient complaining of chest pains, you will not think of. Probably patient will have some symptoms relating to urinary tract. Most commonly, they will present patient, doctor, I have dysuria, they will have harara, whatever, the burning micturition. We call them dysuria or burning micturition, they will present as I am passing urine more frequently, especially females. So, frequent voiding. Some people, if they have cystitis, they will complain of pain in the suprapubic area, just above the bladder, in the bladder area. Some of them, they may present with hematuria. Some people say, I have a cloudy urine. There are different symptoms. All of them, they are not doctors. They will present in their own way. But most of the symptoms, they will relate to urinary tract. And if the symptoms involve these voiding, dysuria, some hematuria, think of cystitis. However, if in addition to those symptoms, if patients say, doctor, I have some backaches or renal, if the patient points to this area, renal angle area, that I have pain in this area, together with high-grade fever, chills, patient may have certain nausea and vomiting. In addition to those symptoms, then consider the patient might be having upper urinary tract infection. So there are certain clues in the symptoms. So patient may be suffering from pyelonephritis. So flank pain is an important symptom. So if the patient comes to you in emergency room or in the clinic or outside during your practice, when you see that patient has some infection in the urinary tract, ask, particularly if patient does not mention themselves this symptom, ask, do you have pain in the back, do you have pain in the renal angle area, or specifically ask for fever, nausea, different symptoms. Just you want to try to differentiate whether the patient has got upper tract infection or lower tract infection. And if in addition to these symptoms, patient comes as hypotension state, lower blood pressure, and patient in state of shock, think that patient may be undergoing or had complication in the form of urosepsis. Urethritis, I already told you, this usually happens with females mainly. They present the dysuria frequency, but if there is urethral discharge, especially if the patient gives history of travel or history of extramarital contact outside the marriage, then think of sexually transmitted disease. This is more common in Western societies, where you ask for new sexual partner and different other things. If there is cystitis, infection involving the breast, again it's easy to understand. Patient will have same symptoms, but in addition to that, patient may complain of pain in the suprapubic area. So then you think probably patient is having cystitis. Some people will complain of cloudy urine, male odor, or doctor, I have some bad smelling urine. Although I don't know, this is a very non-specific symptom. You cannot rely much on this symptom, because this is a subjective phenomenon. It depends on the person. So urine is always smell. So I don't think so. I disregard this symptom. I don't pay much attention. But many people have mentioned this. And then you can do certain tests to confirm the urinary tract infection. And you have the details of that. Certain hipsticks tests, microscopy is to confirm your diagnosis. It's just to photomicrograph an acute cystitis patient with severe inflammation in the bladder area, especially the posterior bladder wall. This usually happens in diabetics. In cystitis, infection usually starts from the is limited to the bladder. Bacteria enter from the urethra and stay there. Patient will present with symptoms I already mentioned, suprapubic pain, dysuria, hematuria, frequency, different kind of, people explain in different ways. But if it's not treated properly, it can ascend through the ureter to reach the kidney parenchyma. And that situation is called pyelonephritis. So, the parenchyma is usually an ascending infection, it sends through the bladder. This is an important infection to understand, to diagnose, and to treat. Fever, although it can happen in cystitis and urethritis as well, but it's much more a common symptom of pyelonephritis. And grade of fever is not an important, it's the development of fever. Some people may present with chills as well, along with that. Some may have some other generalized symptoms like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, increased pulse rate. But important symptom which will give you a clue is the costovertebral ankle tenderness. When you think of pyelonephritis, when you are examining the patient, look for tenderness at the costovertebral angles bilaterally. So if patient has got pyelonephritis, they may become tender in that area. That is an important clinical sign to elicit any patient who has got pyelonephritis. Some elderly patients or transplants or diabetics, they may present as shock, like low blood pressure or hypotension, and acute renal failure, and it can be complicated by multi-organ failure also. When you will do CBC, you will find their white cell count is raised or high. So leukocytosis is an important lab investigation. And then you confirm your findings by doing certain more tests on the urine. So this is a histopathology specimen of patient who had pyelonephritis. Normally we don't do biopsies in any infection. That is in contraindication. Active infection is contraindication to renal biopsy. But anyways, this is just to show you. Here the infection involves the kidney parenchyma. You can see there are a lot of inflammatory cells, granulocytes, or polymorphic leukocytes involved in the kidney interstitium. Normally the three or four structures we look at during kidney biopsy. look at the glomeruli. These are glomeruli. This is the main filtering mechanism. The tubules, this one, and rest is the interstitium, apart from blood vessels. So here the infection involves the interstitium of the kidney. All of the interstitium is infiltrated by granulocytes.
You can just touch the board. You can touch the board and it will go to the next slide.
Okay. Now, pyelonephritis. We get more worried with pyelonephritis. The reason being simple, that it can get complicated if not treated early, especially in those patients who has got diabetes. And what are the complications? Some of them, as I already told you, patient can develop perinephric abscess. They can have necrosis of the papilla, papilla necrosis. They can develop into septic shock. In the future, they can cause obstruction of the ureter. There are many possible complications of pyelonephritis. So we have to treat them early and quickly. And if not treated properly, in future that can develop into scars and can lead to chronic pyelonephritis. If pyelonephritis happens during pregnancy, then there are chances of increased preterm labor. Patient can develop labor earlier than usual. This will show you a patient who had perinephric abscess. You can see there is a bulge in the renal angle area. It's very obvious. You won't see these kind of patients very frequently, but occasionally you see. But if you see, don't miss it out. That patient had pyelonephritis complicated by perinephric abscess. Very easy. And treatment here involves antibiotics plus certain other things like ranitidine. Now, how to diagnose? First thing is history. If patient comes with low urinary tract symptoms, you suspect urinary tract infection. It's not difficult to suspect. Physical examination, yes, you do all the systems, but it's rather limited. Most important is look for suprapubic tenderness. I think we'll wait for that. Wait for renal, examine for renal angle tenderness, sign of pyelonephritis, tachycardia, whether patient is in shock or not, check the blood pressure. So these are simple things you can see. But let's go on to the lab. There are certain evidences, if you're not sure, you can ask for laboratory investigation. Simple is to check the urine. Because infection has involved urinary tract. So you don't check the sputum. You check the urine, so simply. There are certain simple tests available, bedside tests. If you're sitting in an outside clinic, you don't need sophisticated labs. Just take some sample of urine. There are dipsticks available in the ward. All the ward, they have dipsticks. Just dip a stick in the urine, and there will be certain clues. Then you can order the same urine for culture as well. Because you want to know what is the exact organism and what is the sensitivity. You have to do blood culture also. But for simple uncomplicated cystitis, you can diagnose without this lab test. Uncomplicated cystitis, just simply patient comes with dysuria and suprapubic pain, you don't need this test. You can start treatment without this test. So in that situation, history physical examination alone is enough. Even urine analysis you don't need to do. But if you want to confirm, you can do simple urine analysis. So it's very easy to diagnose.
No, but
okay. So these are the dipsticks available in the world, everywhere in the clinics. Normally, there are many data you can gather from this dipstick. Like it can tell you the pH of the urine, it can tell you about the specific gravity, whether the proteins are coming or not, glucose, levels of blood or ketones. But here, when we are suspecting infection, we are not concerned much about these things. We are more concerned about other information. And one of them, whether leukocyte is positive or not. If it is positive, that probably patient has got pyuria. It's a screening test for pyuria. The pus cells are coming out in the urine. Second thing what we are interested in is whether nitrates are positive or not, hydride. If it is positive, it is again a screening test for a gram-negative bacteria, bacteria urea. except Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas does not give this test positive. Rest all the gram-negative organisms can give rise to nitrite positivity. So these are the two information we are looking at the distance. When considering UTIs, although we can get all other information, but when in concern about urinary tract infection, these are you should focus on. So nitrite, as already mentioned, is a screening test for bacteriuria, whether the bacteria are present or not. Certain organisms, they can give rise to false negative nitrite, like when there is enterococcus or vitamin C presence or urine which has stayed in urine the bladder for less than 4 hours. For this test to become positive, urine has to stay in the bladder for at least 4 hours to bacteria to grow. Only then this test will be positive. Leukocyte esterase is again a screening test for pyuria, pyrus or pus cells. And normal threshold is 5 to 15 WBCs per high power field. If more than 5 to 15, then this test will be positive. Again, there are certain false negatives with this test also. There are certain problems with that. Like if the patient has glycosuria, presence of glucose in the urine, or patient has got concentrated urine for any reason. Dehydrated, that can cause false positive results or even negative. Certain drugs like cephalosporin, cefalexin, tetracycline, presence of oxalates in the urine, even vaginal debris can give false results. So these tests we found very frequent at the bedside, and even morning round presentations people will mention of these tests, but they are not very reliable. At least that can support your suspicion. So pyuria, normally we see less than 5 WBCs when you suppose when you take the urine, spin it in the centrifuge tube and then examine the sediment under the microscope. Normally you should not be able to see, identify more than five white blood cells in that specimen. If it is more than 5, probably this is an evidence of pyuria. And then when you culture, the bacteria should be less than 10 raised to power 5. If more than 10 raised to power 5, colony forming units, again a sign of infection or supportive of infection. So these are the two cut limits generally. But remember, all these things go in hand in hand with the symptom of the patient. Just to summarize all these things, when you suspect UTI, you want to do certain tests, test the urine. Look for leukocyte esterase positive, whether it is positive or not. If it is positive, supports your diagnosis. Look for whether nitrite is positive or not. If it is positive, again it supports your diagnosis. And if you want more accurate results, examine the urine under the microscope. These were the dipstick tests. These are the tests done under the microscope. Okay. If you detect more than 5 WBCs per high power field, there are different ways to see. Sometimes some labs give in milliliters, there are different counting chambers. But if people see, you see directly by yourself, then you count more than 5, it's a sign of pyuria. And if you culture the urine, if the colonies are more 100,000, 10 raised to power 5 or 100,000 colony forming units, it's a quite important sign. But all these tests are not 100% reliable. They are not 100% specific, they are not 100% sensitive. But yes, it supports your suspicion. The important thing is how you collect the specimen. This is a problem in especially middle-aged ladies or elderly ladies who are wheelchair bound. So when you see them frequently, they will come with symptoms suggestive of urinary tract. And when you do tests, you get variable results. The problem is they don't collect the urine specimen correctly, nicely. So collection of the specimen is we should always advise how to collect the urine specimen. In the male is easy. Ask them to urinate and bring the bottle in the middle of the stream. So midstream urine in the middle of the specimen should be from the middle of the stream, not the first part, not the last part, from the middle. Although it's not easy to get, but that's the accurate specimen. Then it will give you accurate results. and it should be early morning, generally. Urine which has stayed in the bladder for overnight, that will give you more clues, more positive. So collection of specimen is very important. Usually advise them, normally in the clinic we have a paper, how to collect the specimen. We always stress them if you want to be accurate. If you collect samples from the urinary bags or bed pans, that will not be representative. That will give you false results. Results will not be true. Because a lot of contamination will happen. So avoid. So getting a specimen right is a proper technique. The proper technique is the way when you clinch the proper diagnosis. If somebody asks, what is the most reliable specimen, then you take it directly from the bladder. Clean the area, stick in the needle, you get the specimen. But generally we don't do it. But that is the ideal specimen. And as I already told you, urine should have stayed in the bladder for at least 4 hours. That's the requirement. Now, if you ask for culture of the urine, so how to interpret that culture? So different results will come. So usually the cut limit or limit is if you get more than 100,000 colony-forming units, above that all are positive. Below that, doubtful. If it is less than that, that is a doubtful result. However, in patients who are diabetic or transplant or patients who have catheters, we do take them as well. We don't totally disregard them. But generally for you, remember this figure. Any bacteria more than 100,000 is positive. So, interpretation of urine culture again is an important thing. You need at least 100,000 colonies per milliliter to be a standard. Although it can miss up 50% of cases, but that's the general recommendation. And if you get multiple organisms in a with the culture results, you should have E. coli, gram positive, different, suspect probably it is a contaminated specimen. The specimen was not right. So that situation, you don't rush to treat, you ask for a repeat culture. After proper technique, collection of technique should be correct the technique and then reculture the thing. The advantage of culture is that you can ask for sensitivity. Different antibodies are available. If you want to be more accurate, you ask for sensitivity and you can tailor your therapy according to the sensitivity. I was talking to you about the microscopy. When you're looking at WBCs in the microscope, under the microscope, but if you see WBC casts, these are usually when the severe infection, the WBCs they get stuck in a sort of, they take a tubular shape. We call them casts or WBC casts. These are very significant, these are of urinary tract infection, and it's just pyelonephritis because these are coming from the kidney tubules. Now, this is another term called sterile pyuria. Some examiners are fond of asking this question. In Revival. Or, what are the, do you know some of the causes of sterile pyuria? First, try to understand what is sterile pyuria. I already mentioned it is a pyuria in the absence of bacterial infection. There is pyuria, you'll see WBCs, lot of WBCs in the urine when you are doing microscopy, but there is no other evidence of infection. There is no bacteriuria, culture is negative. So culture is negative, but you're still seeing WBCs in the urine. So that situation is called sterile pyuria. Pyuria is there, but patient is not having infection. So there are other reasons of pyuria apart from infection. So what are those? So generally, they will be happy if you answer that patient might have renal tuberculosis. What is a rare infection? That's one they would like to listen. Although the most common cause is if you treat incorrectly urinary tract infection. If you don't give the right antibiotic, the right dose, then symptoms will disappear, culture will become negative, but you may still be seeing WBCs in the urine. So improperly treated urinary tract infection is the most common cause of sterile pyuria. Other causes are if there is contamination of that urine by vaginal secretion, if the specimen has not been collected properly, that's another cause. Chronic interstitial nephritis, if there are tumors in the urinary tract, again it is a cause of sterile pyuria. certain drugs like cyclophosphamide is a chemotherapeutic agent that can also cause such a albuminuria. If patients who are have renal transplant, if they get rejection of the kidneys, that transplant that can develop into cystinal pyuria. Any trauma in the genitourinary tract will give rise to pyuria. Prostatitis again also. Renal tuberculosis I already mentioned. I put it at last, but some of the examiners, they only know a few of the things. So just remember renal tuberculosis, because they have forgotten most of the other concepts. So it's an not see very often, but this question some examiners like to ask. Now let's come to the other situation, asymptomatic bacteriuria. So when we call a patient having asymptomatic bacteriuria, this is a rather reverse of sterile pyuria. Here, patient will have infection, evidence of infection in the form of bacteriuria, will have culture positive, but patient will not have symptoms. You do test, patient comes to be asymptomatic, there are no symptoms. But for some reason, you check the urine, culture the urine, you ask the sister, nurse, okay, send all the septic screen. She will send blood cultures, put everywhere, and she will send the urine culture also, it turns out to be positive. So that situation is called asymptomatic bacteria. It has got important therapeutic implications. And you need again 100,000 colony-forming units to label it. So, it is a microbiological diagnosis. The diagnosis from the laboratory will give you the diagnosis. It's not your clinical situation. So, positive urine culture, in the absence of signs of urinary infection, that's the proper definition of asymptomatic bacteriuria. It's quite prevalent, especially in females. Okay, certain populations. Normally we do not treat that. But in certain situations we don't ignore. If the patient is pregnant, and we all the pregnant ladies, when they come to their first antenatal visit, they start visiting frequently. So we test the urine for presence of asymptomatic bacteriuria. Because if you don't treat them, it can lead to pyelonephritis and other complications, and then patient can have preterm labor, different other situations. So do not ignore asymptomatic bacteria in a pregnant lady. Otherwise, you don't need to treat them. So, but keep looking for that. Now, what are the different organisms involved in urinary tract infection? Probably by now you have almost 100% known what is the most common organism, E. coli. Don't say any other word. Okay, but it's very easy, E. coli. You can see how common it is as compared to the almost 80-90%. Other infections caused by Enterobacteria or E. coli. Others can cause like Proteus, Klebsiella, Entomophagus. Most common cause is E. coli. You can see how common, how it will be. In certain condition groups, it can cause more than 60, even 70, 80% infection. Klebsiella and Proteus are also significant cause. Now, if you want to go to more sophisticated tests to localize the infection, when there is a patient has got complicated UTI, you can do certain more invasive tests, some non-invasive or invasive tests. So different tests are available, but the most easy one is ultrasound. Ask for ultrasound of the kidney, urine, ureter and bladder. Non-invasive, patient doesn't have to take any contrast, very easy to perform, done by technician, doctor will report it. Okay, normally we don't do ultrasound for UTI, you don't need ultrasound. If you are accurate in taking history, you can diagnose by history. Or by simple urine test, you can diagnose. You don't need these kind of tests normally. But if you want to go further, so these are the techniques available. So these are all radiological tests. So ultrasound is the most cheap and easily available. Some urologists, they ask for intravenous pyelography. Especially if there are stones obstructing the urine tract, causing infection, they ask for this test. They inject a dye and see the urine tract as such. The whole of the urine tract is seen in IVP. Now the recent term is IVU, because it does not tell us only about the pelvis of the gate gives the information about the whole index. So the intravenous urography is a better word instead of IVP. Traditional word is IVP, but word, more recent word is IVU. You can do now CT scans are available, MRIs are available, you can do CT scans. If you want to special, we usually do ask for these tests when there is complications. Then we want to localize. So then we ask for these kind of investigations. You can ask for nuclear tests also, nuclear scans, we call it EMS. This is an agent or dye which we use for EMS, and it's a very long word. Dye missile success thing is a very long word to do. Now this is just to show you how the CT will show. This is a case of pyelonephritis. You can see there are hypodense areas, different hypodensities. There are different levels, different cuts at different levels of the kidney. So that can be shown as like this. This is just a photomicrograph of a renal scan. So if you do renal scans, these are nuclear medicine that you've done in nuclear labs. They inject isotope and is seen under gamma camera, and then you can see localized infection with infection. Here you can see there's an indent at the cortex. And the important differential diagnosis of this indent, if you see this, don't always consider infection. There are other possibilities always. Like suppose it can be an old scar. Okay, that will give you a diminished area of diminished uptake. And it can be an area of renal infarction. These are the possible differential, but I don't think this is going to be asked. Just now, let's, after all this discussion, let's go how to we are going to treat them. That's again very easy. But try to categorize them before you, then the treat therapy becomes easy. And categories, you, as I already mentioned, is it a complicated UTI or is it an uncomplicated UTI? Treatment will be different. Okay. Is it the upper urinary tract infection or lower urinary tract infection? So try to put them into a category. Then the therapy will be easy, very easy to, because there are little bit differences in the treatment. Do not try to remember all the drugs by themselves. Just try to, what are the principles of management? Focus on that. If patient got uncomplicated cystitis, it was just the bladder in a woman. You don't need cystic lab, you can treat just based on the symptoms. And if you want, just strip test dipstick is enough. So lower UTI or cystitis in women, just give a short course of therapy. Just 3 days are quite enough. You want to 3 to 5 days therapy is sufficient. Now different drugs are available in the market, in the hospital, in the books, you'll find so many drugs. You don't need to remember all of them. Just remember one or two commonly used drugs. But at least you should know the principle. You have to give antibiotics for how long? Shorter duration. Don't need to give longer duration antibiotics. Yeah, I just brought them, just to few of them. They're commonly used. This is a Ceftriaxone. Trade name is Ceftriaxone. But always in the exam mention the generic name. Don't mention the trade name. Don't mention the name of the companies. The drug is trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Companies make with the name of Ceftriaxone, some say Bactrim, different words, but different companies. So remember the generic name. Okay. I won't consider it the first choice. It's an older drug, time tested. People used to, when we were students, this was commonly used, but no more. More commonly used are quinolones now, if you are sure about urinary tract infection. And there are different drugs available in that group. Like ciprofloxacin, norfloxacin, different drugs. Just remember the group. And from each group, one or two drugs, if you remember, are sufficient. Cephalosporin is another group. Okay. There are different groups available. But always see what drugs are available in your hospital. Just pick any one of them among those groups. Because suppose in this hospital we have ciprofloxacin, maybe in King Faisal we have norfloxacin. In military hospital, we have ofloxacin. There are different drugs. Each hospital, they don't bring all the group. The pharmacy brings one of them. Depends on the company which enforces it. So whatever, must stick to what is available. And most of the time, they are a good drug, all of them. So short course in cystitis. But in men, this is regarding females. In males, the same drugs, but extend the duration. instead of 3 days, also extend it for 1 week. Because I told you, consider any infection in the men as complicated. It's not as simple as in females. So drug will be the same, dose will be the same, extend the duration. So probably 1 week will be okay. Again, same group of drugs. Even you can do augment and also. And in men, if after a week of therapy, patient does not improve, same patient might have underlying prostatitis. This again, certain oral drugs, the list of drugs, okay, even more than this in the market. The more common is quinolone group. Levofloxacin, there are different names available. It depends on your choice and what is available in your hospital, where you are working. So 3 day course is reasonable. But in men, you extend the course, and these are all whole list of drugs you can pick up from. Now let's go on to pyrophosphate. So that needs more attention. Again, you see, it's a complicated pyrophosphate or uncomplicated or simpler one. So you judge by the symptoms of the presentation. Suppose if patient has got mild pyrophosphate, mild to moderate. Because you have to decide when you are examining the patient in emergency room, should I admit this patient or should I send him back? And he can take the drug at home. That's an important question to answer when you are on call. And you will be on call once you finish your final year. Very quickly. So you have to decide. First, that's the first question you have to. Should I admit this patient or can I discharge this patient home? So just based on your clinical judgment. If you think the patient has got mild to moderate, I don't know, right, you can treat as an outpatient. You can send the patient home, but with antibiotics. Okay, and you can again choose from quinolone group, that's the most type, all other drugs available. But usually the duration is even further extend the duration, up to 2 weeks. I generally recommend for 2 weeks then. Okay. This is a serious infection. This is an infection of the renal parenchyma. So it's better to treat completely rather than do not under treat them. You can use a simple dose, it depends. It's once a day drug, you can use from there. However, if the same patient has got more severe symptoms, severe illness, high grade fever, chills, and patient looks more unwell, and you think that patient may not be able to take orally drugs, if patient is vomiting, and you are doubtful whether the patient will be compliant with your suggestions. Some people, they don't follow your advice. And you are not sure whether the patient will take the drug as advice, or if the patient is pregnant. These are the certain areas. Or in any situation, you think the patient has got serious infection. You're not happy to sending him home. Admit the patient. Okay. And give him intravenous drugs. Because here the compliance will be overcome, the nurse will give the drugs, not the patient himself. And it will go directly into the bloodstream. So in that situation, safer to admit the patient and treat. Now these are the oral drugs you can give for pyelonephritis. Before I gave you the list of drugs which can give in cystitis or lower urinary tract. So this again list of drugs you can use orally, patient tablet form. Again, you see the quinolone group is the more favorite here. Okay. Most of the people they use quinolone. Other than the list of other drugs. And if you know if the culture results comes to you and you can tailor the therapy. Sometimes, because they are commonly used, bacteria may get resistant to this therapy. Okay. So in that situation, you have alternatives available. So you can then choose the alternative. Like you can use cathexin, intravenous aprodoxin, the list of drugs available, once you know the organism. So unwell patients are admitted. And you give IV drugs, parenteral therapy. And again, you can choose for different kind of cephalosporins. Our ER people, they give as a default ceftriaxone. Almost 90% patients get this drug because it's easily available in all of them. It covers chest infection, you take many ceftriaxone, they give. There are different generations of cephalosporins available. First, second, and third generation. Even fourth generation is here in the market. So this is the third generation of the market. Do not be specific about one drug, just remember the groups. You can give fluoroquinolone as well. And if the patient is on IV drugs, give it for a sufficient period of time, like 2-3 days. Once the patient has improved or patient starts taking orally, you can convert them to oral drugs. But in certain situations, if complicated pyloderma, antibodies alone may not be enough. You have to do certain other procedures.
Drainage.
So this is again a list of IV drugs. So you can see there's so many drugs available. Okay. Again, why these quinolones are commonly used here? Because they have good penetration in the urinary tract. That's the reason. Other drugs, they are effective, but they do not penetrate urinary tract as well, like quinolones. So that's why they are commonly used. Like septin also has got good penetration. They can even penetrate the cysts. So because of the good penetration, pyelonephritis, again it can convert into complications. Like I told you, pyelonephritis. If patient develops pyelonephritis, you need to drain this. So antibiotic alone may not be enough. You need to drain the abscess and then gather the antibiotic. And you can do certain imaging studies, like I told you, IVP, CT scan, MRIs, to localize the infection and treat accordingly. So this is just MRI of certain abscess which has developed in the lower part of the knee. You can see here.
Sure, MRI.
I think we'll leave it here. Okay, do you have any questions?